This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your hosts, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
Welcome to On the Couch. This is Earl J. Bell, LCSW,
and I am Benny Massey, LPCC, and you are on the couch.
We want to apologize for the late start and maybe a change in the quality of the broadcast. We're having technical difficulties, but we're getting by as much as we can. And tonight, we are going to look at different myths and misconceptions of mental health. And the reason why we both think this is important to explore is to dispel some of these beliefs that people may have that aren't exactly true and can also encourage people to believe the or attach the stigma to mental health. And one of the myths or misconceptions is that mental health conditions are uncommon.
And what we know, because we are actually clinicians seeing clients, is there are many individuals, multitude of individuals that suffer from mental illness. It is a real illness and it needs treatment. There are several different types of treatment, but we encourage anyone who is suffering from mental illness to seek out treatment and get the necessary help needed.
It's also important to note that, you know, it's like you say, many people do suffer from mental illness. And I think in the United States, it's something like 1 out of 5 people in America will experience some type of mental illness within their lifetime. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's something that's debilitating that puts them in the hospital. It can be something as simple as, you know, some depression over, you know, something that's going on.
Oftentimes, it's small things that fester that we don't take care of, or we don't work through a process, and it grows, and it plays a heavy toll, places a heavy toll on our psyche, and it can cause a lot of stress and debilitation. So it's very important for you to seek out a mental health professional to help you kind of process and deal with that, maybe to come up with the underlying factors that are making you feel this way. Possibly you don't know what's going on that's occurring, because with mental illness, it's different from physical illness.
Explain that, Benny, because I know that when a person has the flu or they break their arm, you have visible signs and symptoms that, you know, they can, like if they have the flu, they'll have a temperature. If they break their arm, you know, and obviously it's in a cast. And you make a great point. Signs and symptoms of mental illness aren't as visible to people looking in.
Absolutely. Mental illness oftentimes, I don't want to say it goes unnoticed, but we are unaware of why we might be feeling this way, and we don't know how to move forward or to cope or deal with it. And that's why it's important for you to seek out a professional who can help you explore and ask the right questions to lead to the solution or come to a closer proximity of where you need to be to handle the situation.
And you make a great point, Benny. Sometimes we might be feeling some way but not know why we feel this way or what brought on those feelings. And you make a great point. If you have those feelings and you're not sure why or where they're coming from, it's very important to seek out someone to help talk you through those feelings, because you said something I think was real important earlier. Sometimes a small issue as far as mental illness can blow up and turn into something major. And you said something as well. So like I say, only 1 in 5 Americans really will experience mental illness in their lifetime, but 1 in 25 will experience a mental illness that, as you put it, is debilitating. Mm-hmm. So I think that's not as big as the 1 in 5 who has mental illness, but it is a rather large number.
And oftentimes people think because, for example, if you lost a loved one, some people might recover from that pretty quickly, and they might be able to bounce back, where others might struggle, and it might take weeks, if not months, if not years, for them to bounce back and to feel a part of society again, resilient. That could possibly, and I believe it very well, would possibly improve more substantially if you have someone you can speak to, someone professional who can help you explore again and review some of the thoughts and even the subconscious that you might not even be aware of.
And I think it's important to, you know, touch on what we touched on our last podcast was the different levels of care. Just because you have mental illness and you go to see someone, a professional, doesn't mean you're going to end up locked away in a hospital. Mm-hmm. We also want to encourage our callers, or listeners, if you'd like to call in, we're taking calls 917-889-3093. So give us a call and we'll get you on the air. And if you have comments or questions, hopefully we can help answer those. One more, I think, misconception that you might hear a lot of, and I don't know really the origins of it. You might. The fact that, you know, even as an adult, if I'm having mental health issues, it all comes from bad parenting.
This is a big conception. It's a big misconception that people believe. And I've actually heard therapists say it's the parents. And sometimes it could be. I don't want to say it is, but sometimes it could be. Parents are going into this oftentimes blindly. It's their first child, or they're trying to figure things out. So that is understandable. But I wouldn't equivocate it to bad parenting necessarily. I would possibly say they need guidance. They need support. They need to know that these things happen, and that the kids have all kinds of different issues, and they come with different experiences, and it's important for the parents to stay engaged to better help figure out how to best proceed.
Yeah, and I think it's like you say, I think you make a great point again, Benny, the fact that sometimes parenting styles might contribute, but I think it's all too often, you know, singled out as the factor as to why the mental illness is being experienced by the child. And even as an adult, a lot of times you will hear therapists when they start exploring, you know, an adult's past history and everything like that, they will go back and explore the interactions with the parents. And I think that's an important part, but I don't believe it's the only thing that needs to be explored.
It's definitely an area that we need to look at as therapists to see if there's any factors that could be contributing to the distress the kids are experiencing. But like Earl said, it's probably not. There's no one reason for the problems that the child might be experiencing. It's probably a host of different reasons. And it's imperative that you sit down, or the family or the parent sits down with someone who can help guide them and question them in a way that they can open their mind and explore more of what could be the case.
Right. And it's also important to note that, you know, 1 in 5 kids between the ages of 13 and 18 either have or will have a mental illness. So I think that's important to understand from the concept that, you know, it's not necessarily, like we've said, just the parenting or the environmental factors, but sometimes there are biological factors as well, you know, so it can be looked at as a combination of influences.
Well, Earl, I want to kind of probe a little bit with you and ask you, I know one of the misconceptions is, well, there have been an increase in diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactive disorder. What do you think? Do you think this is a misconception, or do you think this is a real issue that we're faced now? And if so, what might be bringing this about?
I do believe it's a legitimate diagnosis. I agree with you there. It may be overused or overdiagnosed as well. But I think when it comes to like ADHD as an example, when it is overdiagnosed, I think we get too caught up in the medication aspect to take care of it. I think too many times, and ADHD is a great example, if a child's diagnosed with ADHD, all the people around them say, we've got to put them on medication to manage these behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I think before you jump to the medication, I think it's important to explore how the child feels about the ADHD and can the child manage it if he learns coping skills mm-hmm. or different ways to approach the ADHD. One thing I think that is, you know, something that could be explored from my perspective, the behaviors that the child is exhibiting in ADHD, like the hyperactivity, how can we take that hyperactivity and turn it into a positive? Okay, if you've got a child who doesn't like to sit still or is always up, let's take that child out into the community and let him do volunteer work mm-hmm. or something like that. Get them involved in things to where that they're using that hyperactivity in a way that's positive without the medication aspect.
I agree. And just for our listeners, just so you know, this diagnosis is not, it is, I would agree, probably overdiagnosed. However, it's not easily diagnosed. I want you all to know that. For that diagnosis, the child, the youth has to exhibit that behavior in multiple areas. It's not just at home. It's not just at school. It has to be in multiple areas. It has to be consistent. It has to be disruptive. So it's not very easily diagnosed. I want you all to know that. Oftentimes people think, oh, because they're having problems at home, mom goes to the doctor or the therapist and tells the professional this is what's going on at home, and their diagnosis is automatically given, and that's not the case.
Right. Just because a child has a difficult time sitting in their chair for the full hour of school or the class at school, that's not necessarily criteria for ADHD. You know, it's like you say, there are different factors that play in as well. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, it's like you say, I think it should be more difficult to diagnose than probably a lot of times mm-hmm. it is now.
And you mentioned earlier about the medication piece, and medication is very helpful. It can be. But therapy also is very effective. It is a way of figuring out things that capture the child's or the youth's attention and how to harness that and how to, generalize that in areas where when they're in school, there are times when your kid can sit and watch a movie quietly, in control. And there are times where your child might play video games, but there are a lot of things that your child can do. And it's imperative that with a therapist, you can explore areas where the child is controlled and able to perform, I don't like to use the word normal, but normally people would say, and try to replicate that. So it's important for you to be asked those questions and not be offended by those questions or feel like the therapist is blaming you if they go in that arena to try to get the best results for your child.
Right, and that goes along with what we're talking about the misconception that it's bad parenting that causes mental illness. And you make a great point again, Benny. You're doing a great job tonight. I think one of the things that you touched on is the parent needs to realize that it's the child's behaviors, it's the child's illness, and just because they have the ADHD doesn't mean it's an attack or an affront to the parent.
Absolutely.
That's why I think it's really a great idea that the parent needs to be involved, as you said.
Yes. Another myth, well, I would say misconception, and we've kind of talked about this in previous podcasts, is the depressive disorder or major depression, and people just getting over it. You're just sad. It's nothing big. It's nothing. Everyone gets sad. This diagnosis is not given lightly. It is very thought out, and there has to be multiple criteria met for us clinicians, therapists, or physicians to give this type of diagnosis. So there's not one, oh, he cries or he's sad. There's multiple areas that we have to look at, and they have to be consistent upon those areas before we can give that type of diagnosis.
Right. And like the thing that's really important is if you're depressed and people say, well, just get over it. It's really important to realize that a person who truly is suffering from depression can't just get over it. I mean, stop and think. Most people who are depressed, if they could just get over it, they would, you know, to move on. People who are depressed don't like being depressed.
They truly don't. And oftentimes we think, oh, well, it's because they're struggling or, you know, they've lost a loved one. Could be a multitude of different reasons that a person feels, but they're wealthy, famous, powerful people who suffer from depression. So money is an issue. There are people who have lost loved ones, very close loved ones to them, who are resilient and are able to bounce back. So those are not the end-all and be-all of what brings on this diagnosis. And it goes deeper than that. That's what we want you to know. The misconception that it's easily pushed aside, you can push it aside and you can move on, it's easier said than done.
Definitely, yeah. I think one misconception as well, and it kind of ties into what we're talking about, is the fact that a lot of times people will look at someone with mental illness and say, oh, he's just faking it. He's doing it for attention. How many times have you heard attention seeking used in your practice? Yeah. I mean, true, kids will do things to seek out attention, but we all do. We all do different behaviors to seek out attention. I think the thing that really is important is if the kids are seeking out this attention, is it because something's going on with them that they need to explore? And so the thing about faking it, you know, it's like we said a few minutes ago, no one would choose to have a mental illness. And going back to what we said about, you know, the physical illnesses, very rarely do people fake a broken arm or fake the flu,
right.
You know, and nobody would say, oh, you're just faking it if you had the flu.
Right. And I kind of take offense to people who say they're attention-seeking. Who doesn't want attention? Who doesn't want to be seen? Who doesn't want to be heard? Who doesn't want to be a part of? Attention is a everyday thing that we all strive for, that we all long for. So I think when we diminish it to, oh, he's attention-seeking, we're taking that away from people who deserve it, and they might be going about it the wrong way, and we might need to explore that in treatment and therapy, but that doesn't mean that it's insignificant or it is a very important area that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed appropriately and not to make the individual feel less than or diminished that they want to be seen and heard.
Right, and especially with kids, I think too often in my practice, and I'm sure yours, a lot of people will say, oh, he's just attention seeking. He may be, like you say, everybody wants attention, and I think if they're doing it in an inappropriate manner, that is where the clinician needs to explore what is it that's driving the inappropriate manner of seeking the attention.
Absolutely. Another area... we talked about suicidal in previous podcasts, but a lot of people take this lightly and they say, this is not a serious issue. Again, he's attention seeking. I encourage you all not to just move past this or dismiss this, but to address this, to look at it seriously and listen and be present. And try and help them. The most important thing is for them to feel like you're hearing them. Whoever is speaking to you, if they're feeling suicidal or severely depressed, it's an area that is fragile, and we need to look at it that way and not just dismiss it. And I think many times people do just dismiss it, get over it, move on.
It's attention seeking. Especially with kids, I think that's the go-to for a lot of people. Those kids are just saying they're suicidal for attention. Or in school sometimes, well, those kids are just saying they're suicidal to get out of class.
Yeah. Or let's just go out and do something fun and it'll be in the past, it'll be in the rearview mirror. But it's not necessarily that they need to do something fun. It might just be, in most of the time, they need to be heard and they need to be listened to, and it needs to be real for the listener. That's what they need to see, that you see that it's real and that you care, and you're present with them through it.
Yeah, in a way, that is attention-seeking, but it's attention-seeking for serious mental illness.
Absolutely.
Definitely. So, yeah. And I know you've heard this next misconception, that mental illness is caused by personal weakness, that someone who's depressed or going through some type of mental illness, they're just a weak person. Strong people don't get depressed. Strong people can withstand a lot of different stressors.
I have heard this. I want to say I've seen it, but when I work with clients and I've heard their stories and I've listened to their stories, a lot of times their stories are pretty severe. And you have to, you can listen to a piece and think you know the answers, but if you give people time to explain, I've had clients who have gone through a lot of severe happenings in their lives. And when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it all, it is something that changes you and impacts you, and it is something that you can't just brush off. And a lot of times, you know, common folk want to just brush it off.
Why do you think that is, Vinny?
I think because they think they're doing a good job by brushing it off. They think they're going to fix you or let you know, it's okay, we all get sad, we all get depressed, we all get down, we all think about that from time to time, but let's do this, or let's do that, or let's focus on this. And when they're doing that, they're brushing it aside. They're asking that individual, don't think about it, be silent about it, let's move on.
Do you think part of that could come from the individual who's brushing it off? Maybe they have some of the same mental illness and they don't want to face it. And if they can look at another individual and say, just brush it off, you can brush it off, they don't have to focus on themselves.
I agree. I think it's a good question. I haven't thought about it that way, but definitely it's I would say it's an insecurity. It's a difficult thing to talk about. It's a hard thing to face. You don't want to think about your loved one or anyone feeling that way and you feeling helpless.
Yeah, but that also goes again back to the actual physical ailments. If you have a loved one who's suffering from some physical ailment, you get them to the hospital. You don't tell them, just brush it off if you have.
Absolutely. You rush them to the hospital.
Exactly.
And you get them the help they need.
Right.
But a lot of times, well, I would say, and I don't know this quantitatively, but I would say 90% of the time, we look at physical ailments different than mental ailments. And it's sad. It really is sad.
And I think that comes, that contributes to the stigma with mental
illness. Absolutely.
Yeah, because, you know, like we said, nobody would tell somebody with the flu, just get over it, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you're weak for having the flu. Whereas with depression or other mental illnesses, it's, oh, you're a weak person, a weak-minded person, especially when it comes to addiction, which is a mental illness. People a lot of times will say,
absolutely,
oh, they're weak-minded for taking the drink. So, yeah. And I think one misconception that I think is really prevalent now, especially with all the commercials on TV, you don't need therapy for mental illness. Just take a pill and you'll feel better. How many commercials do you see about antidepressants? Which, I'm not faulting antidepressants. I think they have a purpose. But I do think the therapy needs to go along with the pill.
Pills will impact you, and they will change that chemistry to maybe help you get over and move through. But I definitely believe, and I am a therapist, so I might be biased, that talk therapy and working through it and facing it and dealing with it and coming up with short and long-term ways to move through it are going to benefit the client absolutely more, because they've got to figure out a way where when this reoccurs, when this comes back up, they'll know. With a pill, you take it and you might not have to deal with it. You might, I don't want to say forget about it, but it might dull the pain.
Right. And I think the thing about the pill as well is A lot of times, if you're so depressed, you don't know what to talk about or how to express those feelings. A lot of times, an antidepressant or something like that can ease those symptoms a little to where you can start processing through and working on the goals, identifying goals to work on the depression and the mood disorder.
But that framework has to be set.
Exactly.
And the way the framework is set, I would say, is by mental health professionals. And we come in all different shapes and sizes and professions. So I guess what I want to encourage you all to do is there are many misconceptions about mental health, but no, there are individuals trained to assist you and help you work through that and to give you clarity on how to improve and move forward.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health, exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And we're back after that brief break. And like they say, this is On the Couch with Earl J. Bell, LCSW, and Benny Massey, LPCC. And one of the big misconceptions that I kind of wanted to put off until the last to talk about, because we've talked about this before, and it plays out on TV and movies and horror movies especially. The misconception that people with mental health issues or conditions, if you want to call it that, are violent and dangerous. All too often you will turn on the TV and after a mass shooting or anything, you know, that's really sensationalized, it's always a mental illness issue.
I think this is very important because I've been in this field of work for 20 years. I started in 97, so 22 years, and I worked multiple places, and I have seen people suffering from mental illness agitated and frustrated, but I've never seen them honestly wanting to hurt an individual in specific unless they feel threatened. So there have been times where I've had to respond to someone who is all by themselves in a room, but when people have come to the room or tried to enter the room, the person has thrown things and become aggressive. And I think you have to meet them where they are. And you have to, what I did at the time, and this was a long time ago, was mimic the behavior. So if they cowered or pulled back, I would mimic that behavior to let them know, I'm not here to hurt you. I'm here to connect with you. And oftentimes that works, just to be there with them and not to tell them to sit down or tell them to be quiet or yell at them and give them directives, but to just be there present and let them see that you're not a threat. You're not coming to strap them down or do anything to them. I find that effective. And more importantly, most of the times where bad things happen and people get hurt, it's not because of mental illness. If it is, it's because that person feels threatened or attacked. It's not because they're just crazy and they're going out to hurt someone.
And even an individual without mental illness will respond in an aggressive manner if they feel threatened.
Absolutely.
Or like they're going to be attacked as well. And I think that's the thing that people lose sight of. If there is a person with mental illness who reacts to an aggressive move toward them, they're reacting as if, you know, they're threatened, which they may feel threatened, which a normal person would react in the same manner. So, yeah. And the thing that's really important as well about aggression and violence toward a mentally ill individual, and this is something most people don't realize, an individual who suffers from mental illness is more likely to be a victim.
Absolutely.
Than the aggressor.
Absolutely.
Or the violent individual.
I mean, I recall an incident where one of the people that I'm thinking about was in an area where people were not supposed to go in. It was to keep the person safe. And when they were in that area, when anyone tried to come in the area, the person would become aggressive. They did not want that person to enter that area. But the person was jumping on the bed. And I asked them to allow me to try to de-escalate the situation. And when I went in the area, I immediately went in the area jumping, mimicking their behavior. And when I went in the room, I got on the bed and I jumped with them. And as I slowly began to slow that jumping down and sit down on the bed, they also mimicked me and they sat on the bed. So it's all in how you approach the situation, I think.
Exactly. And that's the thing that's really important as well, is how do you approach a person with mental illness? My response to that is approach them like you do any other person. Mm-hmm. Because a person with mental illness, again, the numbers that we cited earlier, I think it's, I can't remember, 1 out of 5
yeah.
Americans will have some form of mental illness. So you stop and think, every time you walk down the street, when 5 people walk past you, one of those people is suffering from some type of mental illness. That's the thing to think about, because the violence that is portrayed on the news by people with mental illness is what people see. You know, they don't put on the news the person with mental illness who's out working and trying to make a living and an effective member of society.
And that's a multitude of people who work in society every day, who suffer from mental illness, who never hurt anyone, who do their jobs. And those are the faces of mental illness that we all want you to know. There are people who struggle, and there are people who can be aggressive and even violent. But that's not the majority of people suffering from mental illness. The majority of people suffering from mental illness do a job just like you and I every single day, and they live their lives. And it's important for everyone to know that. We don't want that fear. I've been doing this work, and Earl's been doing this work probably equally the same time. And I can't speak for him, but I can speak for myself. I've not had a problem with anyone who has been diagnosed with severe mental illness or anger control problems or psychosis. People want to feel respected, and people want to feel that you're going to listen to them. And as long as you can give them that, they usually do pretty well.
Right. And the important thing is to respect each other. And that way, what you give, you get back, especially from anybody in society. But people with mental illness, again, you're not going to know it. You're going to be walking down the street, and people with mental illness will be walking by you. When you go to get your cup of coffee in the morning, the barista behind the counter may have mental illness and you don't know it, but you still engage with that individual. So I think that's the important thing to take from this, besides the different misconceptions we touched on. The fact that there are a lot of people who suffer from mental illness or who have mental illness, and you treat them just like you treat any other individual.
Our conceptions are reality, and it's important for us to get the information, and just having the information is powerful and it's helpful. And that's why we're here now, to try to inform and give you a better understanding of what we deal with and what we see. The reality is people with mental illness are no different. They're no different from someone with a broken leg or a bad cough or whatever physical ailment. It's just they think and perceive a little differently than you and I.
And it's not visible. Right.
So we encourage you all, and we want you all to not be fearful, but try to have a little bit more understanding and a little bit more, I don't want to say sympathy, because they don't want your sympathy. They want to be a part of. They want to feel like you're not looking through them, but you're looking at them.
Right. And the important thing as well is, for our listeners, if you want to learn more about mental illness, I think it's important the National Alliance for Mental Illness, NAMI, has a great website, but I'm also want to caution our listeners from just getting on Google and taking anything they read about mental illness on the internet as fact. That's why I think it's important to go to a reputable website like NAMI or the CDC has a great website as well for mental illness. So as we wrap this up, Benny, do you have any closing words for us?
I just want you all to know that there are many misconceptions about mental illness. I remember one huge one is that African-Americans don't use therapists. They don't go to therapists. And it's a misconception as well. I know many African-Americans that go to therapists and seek out mental health for their children, for themselves, for their relationships. I believe that anyone and everyone can benefit from therapy.
Right, and that kind of goes into the whole thing that mental illness affects all people across all racial, gender, or economic lines. So definitely. Well, guys, we're going to wrap it up. This was a great episode, and if you like it, listen to it again if you want. But be sure and tune in next week for another episode of On the Couch.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.